Russian missiles targeted Ukrainian cities, inflicting damage and casualties throughout the country.
In the northeast city of Kharkiv, at least 21 people were killed when Russian artillery destroyed a school and a community center.
Plus, the United States sees no evidence Moscow is serious about diplomacy as experts detect a shift in Russia's demands as the war has gone on much longer than many anticipated.
At the same time, I think we are seeing Russia continuing to escalate and, if anything, become even more aggressive in Ukraine in terms of its military tactics there.
And later in the program, ensuring the Ukrainian refugee crisis doesn't become a human trafficking one. Today is Friday, March 18th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian forces continue a multi-pronged assault on Ukrainian cities around the besieged country. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn starts us off.
New missile strikes and shelling are reported on the edges of the capital, Kyiv, and the western city of Lviv, where black smoke billows after an early morning missile strike, apparently fired from the Black Sea. Lviv's mayor says they've hit a military aircraft repair facility and a bus repair operation. A nearby resident says his building vibrated from the explosions and people panicked. In the northeast city of Kharkiv, at least 21 people were killed when Russian artillery destroyed a school and a community center. Early morning barrages also hit on the northern edges of Kyiv. At least one person there killed by shelling. And officials say across the country, hospitals, schools, and buildings where people are seeking shelter have been struck. That includes the theater in Mariupol, where the search for survivors continues. I'm Jackie Quinn.
VOA also spoke to survivors of a high-rise apartment building attack in Kyiv earlier this week. Anna Rice narrates this report.
The Russian missile attack on this high-rise residential building in Kyiv on March 14th left at least four people dead. In the wake of the attack, Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko announced a curfew in Ukraine's capital. VOA spoke with a family who survived the attack but lost their apartment. They did not want to give VOA their names.
Last night, the family slept in the bedroom, all three of us on the same bed. Me, my husband, and our grown-up son. We were woken up at 5 in the morning because a balcony door fell on our son. We immediately knew that it was a direct hit. We ran into the living room to the balcony. My husband said there was a fire. We started packing, packed up everything we could and ran outside.
Her family had moved to Kyiv 8 years ago from Donetsk, fleeing the fighting there between government forces and pro-Russian separatists.
We've lived through this in Donetsk, but it's not the same as it was in Donetsk. And we never thought that this could happen to us in Kyiv and that we would be living through this again. It's scary.
While still terrified, the woman believes the Russian invasion has changed Ukraine, uniting people and making them stronger than ever.
Living here for the past 3 weeks in this horror, it's become clear since day one that indeed our country has never been this united.
She adds that if the Russian attacks on apartment buildings are supposed to scare Ukrainians, they have had the opposite effect.
Are they close to succeeding? They aren't even a drop closer to reaching it and will never get there.
With more and more residential areas in Kyiv coming under fire, about half of the city's population has fled. But many others are choosing to stay, to fight and risk their lives to defeat the Russian invaders. For Sergei Lysenko in Kyiv, Anna Rice, VOA News.
As for fighting on the ground, U.S. defense officials say it appears Russian advances remain stalled, making little to no progress as they continue to encounter what repeatedly has been described as stiff resistance from Ukrainian forces. U.S. and Western officials also note Russia's missile attacks are increasingly relying on so-called dumb bombs instead of on precision-guided munitions, an indication that Russian forces may be facing shortages. For nearly 2 hours on Friday, U.S. President Joe Biden spoke with Chinese President Xi Jinping. No immediate readout was available from the White House, but Biden was expected to tell Beijing it would pay a steep price if it directly supports Russia's invasion of Ukraine. A Chinese media readout said that Xi recommended that the United States and NATO also talk with Russia to end the conflict quickly. Ukrainian and Russian officials say that they've made progress in their negotiations toward a ceasefire in the three-week war. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain continues our coverage.
As Russia continues to bomb civilian targets in Ukraine, Ukrainian and Russian officials hold video conference talks to try to reach agreement on a ceasefire. Asked for his assessment of the talks, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken had this to say.
I have to say, on the one hand, we commend Ukraine for being at the table despite being under bombardment every minute of the day. At the same time, I have not seen any meaningful efforts by Russia to bring this war that it's perpetrating to a conclusion through diplomacy.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky laid out his priorities for the talks in a video posted Thursday.
Negotiations are ongoing. Negotiations for the sake of Ukraine. My priorities in the negotiations are absolutely clear. The end of the war, security guarantees, sovereignty, restoration of territorial integrity.
Zelensky said that so far, Moscow has suffered heavier battlefield losses than in previous campaigns in Syria and Chechnya, or even Afghanistan, going back to the Soviet era. Experts tell VOA that Russian President Vladimir Putin has likely been surprised by the fierce resistance in Ukraine, and that Russia's troubles advancing into Kyiv have led to a marked shift in its negotiating position. Anders Östlund of the Stockholm Free World Forum via Skype.
But it's interesting that here the Russians have moved from demilitarization to limited military forces, which is a big Russian concession already. They seem to have abandoned the idea of regime change in Kyiv altogether. But I think that we should interpret this as the Russians desperately saying, this is what we would like to get now. Please, can't we get this? And the answer is no.
Other experts caution that there is no evidence that Putin himself is serious about negotiating with Ukraine. Eric Bratberg of the Albright Stonebridge Group via Skype.
I do think you have seen a shift in some of the official Russian rhetoric, talking about, for instance, an Austrian or Swedish option for Ukraine, which would kind of imply a Ukraine is neutral, but that still has ties to the West, and it's not sort of subjugated by Russia. At the same time, I think we do, you know, we are seeing Russia continuing to escalate and, if anything, become even more aggressive in Ukraine in terms of its military tactics there.
Putin may be so isolated that he is not even aware of the reality on the ground, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor told VOA.
President Putin may or may not know that his initiative, his military operation, his war has stalled. He may not know that the Russian military is running out of food and fuel and soldiers. He may not know this. Until he knows that, he will not be serious about negotiation.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had this to say about potential talks between Zelensky and Putin.
Нет никаких препятствий для организации встречи при понимании, что она.
There are no obstacles to organizing a meeting on the understanding that it will not be a meeting for its own sake, but a contact between the presidents that will consolidate the agreements reached, which are now being worked out through the two delegations. They have met three times in Belarus. Now they are working in video conference mode.
For now, as talks continue, funerals have become a daily occurrence in Ukraine, such as this one in the western city of Lviv, where residents buried their loved ones, soldiers killed in the war. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Speaking on a stage at the center of Moscow's Luzhniki Stadium, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to tens of thousands of people that all of the Kremlin's aims would be achieved. While backing Ukraine with military hardware, Turkey remains strongly opposed to the international sanctions against Russia. Some analysts believe Turkey may be trying to help Russians avoid the restrictions. Dorian Jones is up next.
While the United States and European Union are enforcing powerful financial and trade sanctions on Moscow and closing their airspace to Russian airplanes, Turkey strongly opposes such measures, arguing they are counterproductive. As a result, concerns are growing that Turkey is helping Russians to circumvent the sanctions, says Timothy Ash, an emerging market analyst with London-based Blue Bay Asset Management.
There's been some focus on reflagging of Russian aircraft as Turkish aircraft. There are strong trading and banking relationships between Russia and Turkey. Some media attention on, you know, a lot of Russians trying to set up new bank accounts in Turkey, presumably to try and get around some of the problems they're probably encountering. There's also been concern that some Russian companies or entities trying to export or trade with Russia are repackaging themselves as Turkish entities.
VOA reached out to Turkish government officials for comment, but did not receive a response at the time of reporting. Ankara insists it abides by its international legal responsibilities. But analyst Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says it's not the first time Turkey is suspected of international sanctions busting.
A lot of people hope that Turkey would become a proxy financial center or intermediary for Russia. I wouldn't put it past the current regime to try to repeat the Reza Zarrab incident, $40 billion of money whitewashed to Iran.
Reza Zarrab is a Turkish-Iranian businessman who pled guilty in 2017 in a New York court to massive charges of violating sanctions against Iran. A senior executive of the Turkish state-owned Halk Bank was also convicted. Halk Bank itself is facing trial as part of the same investigation. Turkish private and state banks are also likely to face scrutiny and severe penalties for violating Russian sanctions, says analyst Yeşilada. He warns sanction busting is highly risky, especially as any penalties could affect Turkey's ability to borrow from international markets.
The next 12 months, including the estimated current account deficit, Turkey will have to roll over $200 billion of debt. And any reason for these to seize up is going to cause massive pain, not only to the banks, but to the exchange rate market and inevitably to the Turkish economy.
Ankara's strong military backing for Kiev has generated international goodwill and recognition of the high economic price Turkey is paying, says Ash.
It's carrot and stick, right? The stick is if they ignore the requests from Western governments to close sanctions, that sanction will follow. And at the same time, I think there will be an effort to help the Turks and encourage them, perhaps financially, with more assistance, perhaps, to make sure that they comply fully with the regime as is.
With many of Turkey's economic woes blamed on President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's unorthodox financial policies, some analysts warn any international assistance could well be tied to changes in policy. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Japan was quick and firm with its condemnation of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The move underscores Japan's more assertive foreign policy. It also poses economic and strategic risks for Tokyo, as VOA's Bill Gallo explains.
Earlier this month, Japanese military personnel loaded large pallets onto a cargo aircraft for transport to Ukraine. The boxes included bulletproof vests, helmets, and other non-lethal military equipment. That is much different from the shoulder-fired missiles, drones, and other weapons many Western countries have sent Ukrainians fighting Russia's invasion. But it still marked a major step for Japan, whose pacifist constitution has for decades kept the country out of foreign military conflicts. Although Japanese officials say they have no plans to send weapons to Ukraine, Japan has been on the front line of a Western-led effort to pressure Russia using diplomatic and economic means. The move reflects Japan's broader shift toward a bolder foreign policy, says Corey Wallace, a defense expert at Yokohama's Kanagawa University.
For Japan to actually provide even non-lethal military equipment to a country in the middle of a conflict is remarkable for Japan.
Japan has also imposed sanctions on Russian oligarchs, frozen assets of Russian banks, and this week revoked Russia's most favored nation trade status. Perhaps most notably, it has also begun accepting Ukrainian refugees. Polls show widespread support for the policy.
And that struck me because that doesn't tend to be a thing that Japanese public supports. You look at Afghanistan and Syria situations, they're pretty reluctant to take refugees there.
However, there are risks to Japan's more assertive approach. Japan imports large amounts of oil and gas from Russia. Those imports are likely to cost more. Artyom Lukin teaches at Far Eastern Federal University in Vladivostok, Russia.
No doubt that the relationship has been very badly affected, and the damage will be long-lasting. Even if this war, stops tomorrow, overall it will be a very degraded relationship economically.
Lukin says Japan will probably retain some essential trade, but there will be no new projects or investments. And he says Russia may behave more aggressively toward Japan.
For example, we'll see more military demonstrations close to Japan, like voyages by Russian naval ships along the Japanese coast, like flybys by Russian airplanes close to Japanese airspace.
He says Russia could also be driven closer into China's orbit, a major concern for many in Japan. But Japan's government insists the risks are worth it. Matsumoto Kuchiro is a spokesperson for the Japanese Prime Minister's office.
I think countries around the world are given a choice whether you are going to fight for the universal values that shape the world today, or you deny them, or you pretend that you did not see the events actually unfolding. Japan chose the first option, and to firmly stand with Ukraine, and I strongly encourage other countries, obviously, to take the first option.
Polls suggest the Japanese public is overwhelmingly supportive of the tougher approach. Matsumoto said it's quite natural, given how much Japan has benefited from the existing international order. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations Refugee Agency warns of rising needs in Ukraine and neighboring countries as more than 3 million refugees so far have been forced to flee the country and millions more remain trapped inside Ukraine with little access to humanitarian aid and protection. Many of those fleeing the violence in Ukraine are women and children. The UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Its Causes and Consequences, Shaban Mulally, says it's crucial to ensure that effective prevention and protection systems are in place in transit and destination countries and at all border crossings. I spoke with her via Skype.
This is a concern for us in any situation of conflict and displacement. There are always increased risks of trafficking because people lose their family networks, community networks, their livelihoods. They're in a desperate situation, needing transport and safe evacuation. And in that chaos, of course, there are always risks, particularly where you have children separated from their families, where you have people being dependent on strangers for accommodation and transport. And given the scale and the speed of escalation of the crisis, of course, neighboring countries are overwhelmed. And that is the concern, that those who are moving are able to do so safely, that everyone is aware of those risks and that the information is given to them, and that all those providing assistance are also watching out for where there might be risks. And for people remaining in Ukraine who are displaced, who are without support, there are very serious concerns there also.
There are a number of provisions, UN resolutions put in place to ensure the safety. Can you go into a little bit more detail as to what the expectations are for these countries that are receiving the refugees, and specifically what you are seeing in terms of whether or not these countries are meeting those obligations?
There are several Security Council resolutions which highlight the links between trafficking in persons and conflict situations, and the obligations of all UN member states to protect people at risk of trafficking. The neighbouring states are also part of the Council of Europe, which is one of the few regions with a very specific treaty on trafficking in persons, and that sets out a range of obligations around providing safe accommodation, medical assistance, access to social protection, legal guardians for children who are separated from their families, and prevention in terms of increasing resources to prevent risks of trafficking and ensuring that border officials, that social services, that all those involved in the response are trained and qualified to identify people at risk of trafficking and to refer them for protection. And we know that NGOs on the ground, like La Strada International, who's still operating in Ukraine, they are providing leaflets in Ukrainian at border crossings. In Vienna, Libo IBF are providing leaflets again at the train stations on arrival, highlighting who it is safe to contact and what risks to watch out for. So certainly we know that there is an awareness of the risks. Given the accommodation needs and the scale of the accommodation needs, we are concerned that there needs to be attention to child protection and to ensuring that trafficking networks, traffickers don't, you know, take this opportunity to prey on people who are in extremely vulnerable situations.
And if you are seeing things that are of a concern, are countries being responsive?
Yes, I think people are very responsive. They're aware of the risks while also, you know, overwhelmed with the volume and numbers of people arriving. They're very much aware of the risks and very concerned to ensure that this is done properly, that people are not put at risk, that criminal networks don't benefit from a desperate situation. So absolutely, people are being responsive, states are being responsive, and NGOs are doing incredible work on the ground in a difficult situation in getting information out there, continuing to work also in Ukraine to keep hotlines open, to keep information flowing. So there is a willingness to respond and to do this properly. But as I said, the needs are very great and it is quite an overwhelming situation.
Shaban Mulele is the UN Special Rapporteur for Trafficking in Persons, especially women and girls. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you very much. And thank you for talking to me.
A convoy of volunteer Spanish taxi drivers arrived in Madrid from Poland overnight on Thursday, carrying exhausted and emotional Ukrainian refugees. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has their story to round us out.
A warm and emotional welcome in Madrid greeted Ukrainian refugees driven from Poland overnight on Thursday in a fleet of Spanish volunteer taxis. They arrived to a banner saying welcome in Ukrainian and people lining the streets. Some of the 133 refugees burst into tears. The drivers themselves organized their 40-hour round trip. They said the cost of around $55,000 was funded by themselves and donations. Jose Maria Perez drove his taxi for more than 3,100 miles to pick up the refugees.
We spent the night in Warsaw, and the following night we began the most beautiful and hardest part. It was the hardest part because we heard very tough stories. I just had a sneak peek of the place in which they were staying. I didn't want to see it because I was shocked. It was really moving to see so many people trying to help and so many people in need of help. When we parked and we got the families assigned with their documents, just picture it, we were happy.
Their initiative is just one of many springing up across Spain and Europe to help refugees from Ukraine. When they got to Nadarzyn, near the Polish capital Warsaw, the drivers delivered donations they'd collected and prepared space to take refugees back to Madrid. The taxis pulled into San Anton Church in central Madrid shortly after 1 a.m. and were greeted by Father Angel, who heads an NGO, Messengers for Peace. Some 4,500 Ukrainian refugees have been registered in Spain since Russia's invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. But Spain's migration minister says the real number is much higher.
And that was Lucy Fielder from Reuters News. That'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up with all the latest developments on Ukraine and other events from around the world at voanews.com. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time. I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Good night.